let's talk to Tenet's verbal highs. Let's start the show with Lewis Tenet. Here we go. Guests and interviews that you're looking for, with creators, innovators, and so much more. For all episodes and further info, verbalhighs.com is the place to go.
Welcome to Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs, a podcast, typically podcast from Tamaki Manukau, Auckland, New Zealand. But as many regular listeners will know, I am originally from Wellington, still call myself a Wellingtonian in Auckland. So this is a podcast podcasted from Te Whanganui Atara, which, if you don't know, is actually the name for the harbour in Wellington, but has come to be known more broadly as the name for the wider geographical area. Thank you. Not preloaded knowledge, but Google just a second ago, pondering that. I think I probably used to say that a lot more pre-Google. That's how long it's been since I lived here. I'm being slightly quiet and self-conscious because I am in the lounge room of some dear friends. I'm at the Casa Del 5. They're having a lazy public holiday line, and I have decided I can squeeze in this intro because the rest of this episode's done, you see. I just need to do the introduction, which I was going to wait to do until I got home. But I've got the dishwasher on as well, so I don't know the science of stopping dishwashers, especially dishwashers that aren't my own. So can you hear that? Okay, it's on a slightly quiet one. It was on a lot more weary one before. Good Christmas. Hope you had a good Christmas. Hope you have a great New Year's. I'm not going to stick around and try and say anything too profound for the intro to this episode. Just the general housekeeping stuff. I think if you are new here, this is episode 117, which means there's 116 others. This podcast has been going about 5 years. It's a long-form conversational show hosted by myself. I normally say who I am at the beginning. I'm Lewis. Hello. I talk to Fraser McGuinness, as often happens when I'm in Wellington. I did a episode. Oh, dishwasher's got very loud. I did an episode. I did an episode, as I often do when I'm in Wellington. I did an episode that is kind of historical in a way, in terms of the fact that Fraser was the long-term very present publican, booking agent, and also co-owner for Bar Bodega, which, even if you never attended said venue, you may well have heard of if you have any involvement or interest in New Zealand music. We talk the origins of Fraser, the origins of Wellington Coffee. He's a pioneer in kind of many ways, as he rightly discusses on the podcast. He and a handful of other people are pretty much directly responsible for where craft beer finds itself in New Zealand these days. Some fascinating tales in and amongst that I'd not heard before. The kind of slight skullduggery of the major breweries and trying to quash said, I guess, is revolution too falutin a word, change in said beverage industry. We talked about Fraser's invention of the flat white and others' claims of invention of the flat white. His story sounds credible to me, but I think it might be one of those kind of Pavlovery things. Pavlovian? Pavlovian is in the dessert, not the response. yeah, it's a good chat. It's one of the longer ones. It's a, I'd imagine, often grueling and thankless task, the more grinding day-to-day end of running a venue and having to be present there all the time, as we discuss, but also immensely enjoyable and community building and arts and creativity supporting, as we discuss. I think I'll leave it there. I'd like to just remind you that you can like and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts. You can share the episode. That's Koha for listening on all your socials. My socials are Verbal Highs Podcast on Facebook, Verbal Highs on Twitter. And other than that, off to see the grand today and the rest of the family. Very lucky to be a 45-year-old man and still be able to go and see the grand in her place of residence. So, yeah, we all know what's going on with COVID. That's the other thing. It's a sort of say it, don't say it, say it, don't say it. I just hope I can get down and see her and the rest of the family again next year. Or maybe we'll all have hazmat suits and flamethrowers by then. That's a cheery thought, isn't it? All right, Fraser, take it away.
This is Dr. Tannen's Verbal Highs.
See if you can hear yourself, though.
Maybe.
Madness. So the computer's not needed for this setup. That's just where my notes are.
Line three.
Now, you want to go into... Oh, you've got any of these headphones? Oh, yeah, sorry, mate. Yeah, we'll just go to two. Okay. And just tell me if the volume's too loud in your headphones. Can you hear me? Hello, hello.
I don't think they're working.
They
might be.
No, that's cool.
Wait a minute, this has got a microphone on.
Okay, no, that's cool. That's right. I'll just monitor you, like you say. You can hear me. We'll be fine.
Yeah. It's all good. Carry on anyway.
So take those off.
Yeah. Okay.
And so you listen to podcasts?
Not a lot. I do watch a bit of stuff on YouTube, and I suppose, but I still read books.
And you getting close. So, well, basically, I chat to people for about 60 to however many minutes it takes, mm-hmm. and generally it's a loose bio piece, and a chat at the same time. So, in other words, not a short soundbite snippet interview, which is what the world seems to be full of these days.
Indeed.
So I normally start off with, as we sit here on the Kapiti Coast, where people kind of came on up, and you're actually from the Kapiti Coast, right?
Yeah, sort of pitched up here in 1967 in a roundabout sort of way, because my parents met on the boat going from Britain to New Zealand and Australia, and I was born in Sydney but then left because Mum didn't like Australia, and then so like late 60s.
They were coming out from England.
No, Dad was from Glasgow, Mum was from London.
Yeah.
They met on the boat. I was born in Sydney, then we moved to Ponsonby, which wasn't very flash in those days. In sort of like early 61. And then we went back to the UK, and I did my first 2 years at primary school in Essex, out in Burnham on Crouch, as Ian Dury would say, "Oh golly, oh gosh," kind of lie on the couch with a nice bit of posh from Burnham on Crouch. It wasn't actually a posh place. And then we sort of end up in Ramatty's Beach, and from the age of about seven, and been here ever since, pretty much.
But often the migrant story, especially, quote unquote, in those days, is you just get enough together to go where you're going, and you stay there. So how were they of a means that they could go, we'll try Ponsonby, we'll try here, we'll try there, we'll go back?
Dad was, he was, a carpenter, so and was sort of like a project manager. So we got brought out by Downers.
Right.
And so they sort of send you where they want you to go. And initially we were going to go to Dunedin, and then the job overseeing building Viard College came up. And so Dad got put up in a place in Linden, and the guy who was running the boarding house said, he said, "I've got my family and my kids coming." He said, "Go up the coast." So he drove from Linden, got to Pukerua Bay, and looked down and just thought, this is the place. It's the middle of summer, beautiful day, and had a little tutty around the coast, and we ended up down Rosetta Road, and then moved up to Waikari Road.
So I'm guessing you did like 5 to 7 years old at school in Essex, is that right? If you did your first 2 years there?
Yeah.
So you must have memories of
I remember sliding on the ice on the top of the puddles and the snow. I can remember my uncle coming around to watch the 1966 World Cup.
Yeah.
And I can also remember asking Dad, "Why is that guy burning his guitar?" And it was Jimi Hendrix on TV. Mum's family had a TV prior to the war.
Right.
And she can remember it being turned off and being turned on after the war.
There's three brothers, you guys?
No, I've got three brothers.
Yeah, three and yourself,
And a sister.
And a sister.
And three brothers. We've got one Aussie, three Poms, and a Kiwi.
Right.
So yeah. So.
But you all grew up here, right? In Kapiti Coast.
Yeah, we all went. Ramati Beach Primary School, Kapiti College. So I'm pretty local. And
so, how would you sum up? This is a big question for so many years. Yeah, how would you sum up your high school years out here?
I was never a particularly good student. I never did me homework, was in trouble a fair bit of the time. Used to get strapped at primary school and got caned at college. And in those days, the secondary school was good. It was it was uniform in both sexes. So,
But what you're saying there, is it fair to say, like, you're coming up a lot more against school as a place of authority back then? You know, certain teachers would. You're getting caned for.
I got caned as a year six woman. Yeah. I said to the guy, "Look, I'm a voter this election," and he said, "Yeah, So I don't think he did as much as he probably could. So that was kind of funny. I got in trouble probably more in the at primary school, sort of headbutting against the lay Methodist minister teacher that we had, and mum and dad were a bit liberal, so they let me watch Panorama documentaries. And of course,
yeah, that's what I was speaking. That's what I mean. Like, it's like you wouldn't mean, you know, like it's not. You wouldn't have been a kid who was setting fires or anything. You're just like pushing up against authority.
Yeah,
which is kind of. But you, I see that through your career.
It's sort of looking for the alternative route.
What did you want to be when you grew up? You know, I
wanted to be a marine biologist because I thought Jacques Cousteau was the bee's knees, the big woman back in those days, and. I was a member of the Kapiti Underwater Club, so I used to spend sort of like Thursdays going down the pool and sort of practicing snorkeling and back up and down, and then me and there was a couple of guys whose father used to let us take out his boat, and Vince used to drive the tractor, all under 15, and we used to go out and around the island diving, snorkeling. It was just magical, you know.
Catching food? Yeah. And do you get out much now you live back here? What about general fishing?
I haven't got access to a boat.
You got to at least get a rod, go off the beach.
Yeah, you know, like I was saying before, I said to that teacher, I'm voting for at the next election, and I voted for the Values Party, which is the proto-Green Party. So nowadays I'm sort of not that big on fishing and sort of taking stuff out of the sea because I just don't think
it's not sustainable at the moment. Though, look, I mean, that's a big conversation. I would argue to that when I go surf casting, I catch so little because so much of it's been farmed out. But I was going to say that is arguably sustainable compared to the commercial end, which is what screwed things up for you. But I hear you.
I sort of like, when you see those guys with those little Contiki things now, or even the drone ones, I mean, it's basically just a shortened commercial long line. And my brother goes out fishing a lot, and they're only sort of now bringing in juvenile harp hooker out of the Cook Strait.
It's a big and scary topic. A doco I watched, probably 15 years ago, put a date of 2050-ish on the oceans being empty if we keep going the way we are. And it's one of those things, all you can do is tell people and they kind of look at you and then the conversation goes to something else,
There's apparently more money tied up in the fishing boats and machinery and stuff than there are actual fish in the sea.
Yeah. And also, it's the great Wild West. You know, they put cameras on ships and stuff now and all the rest of it, but really what goes on in those boats, it's not like you've got a business on the high street, is it?
Gold fever. You know, they hit on some fish and they'll just keep fishing. They don't stop until they...
Just last little fishing. So I was in Whiritoa, which is a beach that my parents bought on a few years ago, and the Coromandel is beautiful. And being a Wellingtonian, Coromandel was something later in my life that I've experienced. And so I basically gifted more squid to the sea than I took fish, Fraser. So I see that as sustainable. But the last thing on that is it's really sad. I talked to an older resident there who's been there for years. He explained to me that the boats that you see over winter there sometimes are Korean, what are they called? Long liners. Long liners. And you see them, they sit just, like a ruler length from the edge of where they're allowed to.
When the sun goes down, they move on in.
Okay, back to you.
Anyway, back to me.
So I'm guessing from high school, you find your way to Vic Uni, or is there a few years between school?
I was a touch dyslexic, so I was really bad at English, not strong on maths, But I got through English in geography and science and art, and then I did the sixth form and I passed my biology, geography and art, but didn't get enough in English.
Yeah.
So I had to go back for a second year in the sixth form.
Yeah.
And they sort of looked and thought, what's he doing back here? So I ended up having to do the same subjects that I'd already done, three of them I already passed.
Yeah.
And during that year was the year this Never Mind the Bollocks came out.
Yeah.
And that was quite a eye-opener for me.
So spoke your language.
It spoke my language, and that was sort of the last time I sort of listened to any baby boomer music. And from that point on, I sold my soul to punk, as the line yeah. goes. And, it was a real struggle getting through that. I got through that, and then by the time I left school, 77, 78, whenever it was, there was a big recession on. So we used to, you weren't allowed
Oh, it was carless days and all of that, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and you yeah, weren't allowed yeah. to apply for a job in Porter or the Hutt or Wellington
yeah.
Because there were none, and this was a dormitory suburb. And so we all ended up doing PEP schemes.
Right.
So you had 6 months on, 6 months off, yeah. and you basically started doing all kinds of stuff. You know, I was working in a bridging gang, I was an engineer's assistant, so I spent 6 months giving Deborah Bustin a hand making paper mache sculptures, should I say. And yeah, so that was it. And then I had an accident on my back, and I got some accident compensation money. So I went over to do my OE.
Yeah.
And went and had New Year's Eve, I think it was 1981 or 2 in Germany. And
yeah.
then I visited the Rillos. Got a job in the pub, as you do.
Yeah.
And then it was given
80p an hour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Given the task of yeah. looking after the cask condition beer,
yeah.
which was like a bit of a beer epiphany to me. So, what was this about? And so.
Looking after the what beer, sorry?
The cask condition beer. That's when the Camera Campaign for More Real Ale got going in the UK. It was about not losing their traditional style. So, cask conditioned beer is a beer that is not actually finished at the brewery, is finished by the cellarman in the cellar.
Gotcha.
So it comes into the cellar, you rack it, you put a soft spline in it, which is a bit of wicker, and it sort of bubbles away until you think that it's ready.
So just so I've got my head, I'm on the same page as you. So the publican or someone at that establishment the cellarman is essentially the final brewer in the process.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah
it
yeah.
finishes the beer. Yeah, yeah, so, yeah. yeah. So you'd let it settle, you have the wicker thing in it, and then it gets connected up and you hand pull it. Sometimes you do fine it. But, yeah, and that's when I had my beer epiphany. So when I got back, I used to drink Max Black Ales in the 750.
And they were around in the early 80s, because I was thinking about what craft beer was around then.
Well, as Muldoon said, you know, when he opened the McCashin's Brewery, it's like David and two Goliaths, because
yeah.
New Zealand was a total...
Lion Red, Lion Brown, Rhineck, Double Brown.
Yeah, they were the DB Lion products.
Yeah.
And then there was the DB products. And then DB bought out Leopard to make way for Stein Lager. As Frank Zappa says, you can't be a country unless you've got a lager and an airline. So, but, you know, they were brewing Guinness under licence at Mangatonoki, where they made Tui, and you could get Tennant's Lager and you could get Bass, and apparently the guy from England came out to check on how the Bass is being made and was horrified to see it disappearing and uncarbonated in the milk tanker to be pumped into 200 litre tanks.
I saw you carrying that soda stream refill when you came on in, and a lot of those 4% like watery lagers, I've often said to people, Export Gold especially, like, remind me of if soda stream had a beer flavour. You know, like you put a cap of the beer cordial in.
Yeah. Oh, you know, you could say the same about Heineken, really. So I had that beer epiphany, and then came back. And so the whole craft beer thing sort of, for me, sort of started there. So I used to drink that, Black Mac, and, of course, when we went out varsity, you drank whatever you could afford.
Yeah.
And that was sort of one of the sort of germs of what happened at Bodega.
So you found yourself at Vic, right? Because you did an anthropology degree, right?
I did... one of the PEP screen was working with Deborah Butters doing paper mache, but I'd always, you know, done, got art. So I started painting. And then I thought, oh, maybe I should go and do... I applied to get to Elam and Ilam and wasn't accepted. So yeah. I thought, oh, I'll go to Theodore Vic and do some art history. And so they thought, well, there's no point just doing one paper. So I did 101 anthropology and got the first A of my life.
Great.
And so I ended up doing anthropology, art history, Maori and religious studies.
That's similar papers to what I did 15 years or whatever later.
Yeah, yeah.
The classic BA. Yeah, I did an English 101 as well. Yeah. Mine. Yeah.
Which made me, which was basically the perfect degree for elevated dinner conversation, which was perfect for being a publican.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And anthropology, like, it's an oversimplification. It's like what makes us human, right? It's what makes us a society.
It's a study of all cultures at all times and human history, and one of the ones I did it towards the end was in anthropology, economics, which sort of made you understand that not all economics is actually about money, and you know there is actually you know things where you contra, and there's exchanges where you help somebody, which helps the whole group and lifts the whole group's mana up, and there's a whole lot of the machinations going on in economics. And the other one I did was a study of modern culture, which was really interesting. That sort of helped me sort of come to realise that I could get in there and push the boundaries and do craft beer and just indie music, and that's what I sort of did.
And so I solicit every now and again for certain guests on my social media page, I solicit questions. I say, has anyone got questions? And I've got a bunch I'm going to ask you later. To be honest, from a list of names that you'll know, that we know communally, but I'll ask one of them earlier on. M. Buckingham. M. Buckingham asks, ask Fraser about...
Oh, okay, so...
He has a big grin on his face, folks.
Yeah. Because in those days, and so we, I can't remember how we got it going. We were talking to a bunch of guys, and we decided, and so we used to get together on Fridays, run a, and that would cover the cost of, that's sort of how it got going. And yeah, it was kind of,
because basically the premise is that quite a difficult procedure.
Yeah. But that changed, actually. We changed the... Anyway, so Vic now to do... Yeah. It was just like...
Campus culture is so different now. I mean, I've ended up a teacher at a uni, it's a lot more... I mean, there's... Our security look like to begin with, you know? Very different environment.
I kind of have to be a little bit careful about what I say around this because...
Sure.
Committee.
I can take that last part out if you want. Well, about it was 20, 30 years ago. Do you want me to wipe it?
Maybe.
Okay.
Because it was good for me because I was living out here.
Yeah.
And I off going there.
Okay, so we're editing up to here.
Come out here, go into it.
I can't believe I can't leave this in. You can't tell me all of this stuff and then we've got to cut it out. Okay. You do want me to cut it out, though, don't you? Yeah, absolutely, because you just...
Thanks, Miles.
We'll come back onto the train tracks. So you finish uni, because La Bodega, at least the cafe, opens in 91, right? Oh, 89. No,
the bar opened in 91.
The cafe, rather, opened in 89.
It had been opened a little bit before that. Julian Geisen, who was a friend of a couple of my brothers, he got hold of the butchery in the corner, Abel Smith and Willis, and turned it into what he wanted to be, a New York style all day deli.
87, 88, somewhere around there?
Yeah, 87, 88.
So, I mean, it's a well told story, Fraser, but just before you go on, just for anyone not aware, cafe culture as we know it in New Zealand was not as it was then. Midnight, Sohn hadn't even opened yet.
Yeah. I can remember, so this sort of leads to the Flat White story.
Oh, we'll get to there. But I wanted to know, did any of you have a hospo background? Or you just kind of jumped on it and went, we can do this?
I had one of my first jobs in hospitality was in 1978, working in the 1906 down out here, which was a silver service restaurant. I had to wear a cummerbund and a white shirt and black pants and all that, and serve wine and recommend wine. But in those days, there was only provision for 10 licensed restaurants in the country. All the restaurants were all in the motels and hotels. Otherwise, there was Greek or Dutch owned little cafes. So, and that didn't change till 1989.
I grew up in the eastern suburbs, and the only place that you could get a drink in the whole of the eastern suburbs in Wellington was Giovanni's, the pizza place in Haitaito. Similar.
Yeah, no, that would have been after 89.
Yeah.
Because up to the major liquor license reforms came in 89. And so you were allowed to get a liquor license as long as you followed the laws. You could choose your own licensing hours. So when I got the bar, I went from, I thought, no one's going to want to be drinking past 3 in the morning. So I went for 10 till 3 a.m. Little do I know that Mark Blumsey had this cunning plan to open up Courtney Place, which sort of was a bit like competition, but good on him.
So back to the cafe, just quickly, just get a sense of that. Cafe, so you get that, you guys get that set up. There's how many partners in it?
Well, Cafe Julian set it up, and so I was doing the dishes there, because at Varsity you always have a job doing dishes or working in a bar. So I was doing the dishes there, he was Greek, Romanian, so they learned how to make spanakopita and pistachio and all that. Yeah. And it was only Kona coffee. And then one day, I was flatting with Steve Jinks, who was the maitre d' at the Grain of Salt. And so Julian wanted out, and so Steve and I sort of bought it off him. But just prior to that, I remember walking up Cuba Street and Jeff Marsland comes bouncing out of...
He bounces.
Yeah, you can hear him squawking from 50 metres. Fraser, we've got Lavazza coffee from Italy and an espresso machine. Yeah. I thought, oh my God, okay, yeah, fantastic, Jeff, that's awesome. Scuttle back up to the bodega. Julian, Milo Espresso, I've got an espresso machine and Lavazza coffees. It's all right. So went over and saw his mate Ramiro and got this old Monaco out of the back of the El Casino, and we got that in a store by Darvall, the old Croatian guy.
Yeah.
And
again, highly uncommon in Wellington. You could get a cappuccino in Melbourne when I went there, but
there
not
was
here
a
yet.
Couple of espresso machines around in like the Italian restaurants, and the odd one, I'm not sure, but I think City Limits may have had.
So you get it plumbed in, you get it into the cafe?
Got it plumbed in, got it going. It was a really old bugger. And so there was Midnight Espresso and Espresso Holic and us, we were sort of like the new kids on the block, and we started to do all-day breakfasts, as Julian had been doing all-day breakfasts, but then all of a sudden it really kicked off.
Yeah.
And so Wellingtonians started to come out Saturday and Sunday morning brunching.
Yeah.
And it
went hitherto pretty much unknown.
Didn't happen.
Yeah.
It didn't happen. All of a sudden the sort of, I don't know whether there's a critical mass of people who had been overseas who had experienced it, and a critical mass of people in hospitality. Because prior to that, all the chefs were trained in the army, all the forces, and all in the cafe stuff, we actually just sort of cooked ourselves. So I remember Sam hungover laying on the floor doing orders. And we had a big, huge hot plate, and I used to make the hollandaise sauce out of a magic can, and we had
hungover with hollandaise out of a magic can.
Yeah,
no,
mate. And it was like, it was just your basic fryer on a big, huge plate.
Yeah.
And I used to do a jumbo mix, which was tomatoes, mushrooms, and onions, and Vogel Brett and Molenberg, and out it went. And we were doing like 120 breakfasts.
Great.
And it was just humping.
And so you were learning how to do short order chefing fairly quick, smart.
The
art of timing and getting everything out hot.
Yeah. It was always waiting for the bloody toast. Flatten with Steve. Steve was working with Didier Horan, and he was a French chef. So he came and said, I'll work for you for a year. That was great, and that really just lifted the food up, and we got the turnover up, and then we thought, we want to get a BYO. And it turns out a BYO was as hard to get as a
license.
A license. So we turned the stable, what had been the stables out the back, into the bodega. Got, what's the name? Perkins.
That's all right. It'll come to you.
It'll come. Wait a minute. Not Robin. Anyway, a friend of mine, she was an architect working for at Athfields, and so she did the...
Ms. Perkins.
Yeah, Ms. Perkins. And we so we sort of styled her on late 50s, you know, Warner Brothers cartoons, the bugs, you know, so they had the curves and the colours and the angles.
Oh, the bar downstairs.
Yeah, right.
I never knew that.
Yeah, and so all the colours and that. So, we, yeah, because, yeah, we were... It was, I can't remember why we chose to do that.
Now, you mentioned before we moved downstairs, it's so much to fit in, Fraser.
But Nat Perkins.
Nat Perkins, great. Because I know what that's like. That would have sat in the corner of your head niggling. Yeah, good, great. So, as I say, you've a lot to pack in here, Fraser. We're moving at a pace. But so before we moved downstairs to the bar, you already mentioned it. I had to laugh because I hadn't seen you for years. That sort of press a few years ago about who invented the flat white, and knowing you and knowing, like, I just don't even know how you got drawn into that argument, but
because we got the espresso machine from Ramiro, and there's us at midnight, and the coffee was not bad actually. You know, we were using Tea Coffee World's coffee, and so there's the three cafes going, and that was cool in the spring through summer, but in autumn and beginning winter, the milk wouldn't fluff because there wasn't enough fat in it.
Yeah.
And so I've got three jugs there.
Yeah.
And I'm fluffing away. Because in those days, everybody wanted a cappuccino with like a
mountain
with chocolate on top.
Exotic.
Yeah, mate. And so but I can't remember who the woman was, but she always was immaculately well-dressed. She's like a corporate-looking woman.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was a bit scared, and I had these three jugs now. For life of me, I could not get the milk to fluff enough to make a cappuccino.
Yeah.
So I just poured it into the cup and went up to her and said, look, I'm sorry, but it's a flat white.
Yeah.
And so Steve wrote it up on the blackboard, and then next thing you know, they had him down at midnight, and it sort of spread from there. And then when... and it's actually spread all over the countryside. And in fact, we had, I'm pretty sure, we had them before Auckland. It was a Wellington thing.
Yeah.
And then we sort of, the other cafes started getting to sort of making the milk more silky and
you know,
what have you. And then when Starbucks opened up with their
flat white. This is all the way into the 2000s.
Yeah. And saying it came from Australia. I piped up, I said, no, it didn't. It came from Wellington. I was there at the time. This is what happened. And of course, there's some guy in Sydney, he goes, oh no, he must have come into my cafe, and his flat white apparently was
black. His name was Alan Preston. I've got my legal notes here.
Yeah. His one was a long black with a little jug of hot milk on the side, so how the hell, you know, a flat white's basically a failed cappuccino.
You know what's great? If this was a legal case, Fraser, you've just overturned the evidence I was going to present, which is the article I read on the way up on the train that said this photo of a sign saying flat white from his cafe from 1985. But you've just explained that that flat white was not, in fact, the same
like
beverage.
Some things, I don't know what they call it. You know, both animals sort of.
It's like the pets. It's Pavlova all over again.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's just like all of a sudden, both here and there, there's people wanting loads and loads of. Well, they wanted loads of. You know, there was only lattes, cappuccinos, long blacks, short blacks, pretty much in those days.
Yeah.
And it was just a failed cappuccino.
Yeah.
And then his ones were nothing like that, and I had no idea.
And like, I'm making light of it, but now I think about it, like, you're kind of, your integrity is being called into question. So did it kind of piss you off at the time?
It does.
Yeah.
It wasn't so much for me; it was for all the people in cafes in Wellington who actually we developed the silky tops and the funny shakes and all of that. And it had all started out from that one cock up of mine, and then it sort of went everywhere. And then spread up north to Auckland and everything. And then the Aussies are turning around and say, oh, no, we started it.
But then another New Zealander step in, some guy from Auckland saying that he invented it? So that's just like, oh,
God. Verona or somewhere.
Derek Townsend.
Right. May well be. I don't know. I'd never even been to DKD.
That's right.
I was still flat out with my nose down at Cafe Bodega to, you know. So a lot. It's like converging evolution. You know, animals...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's
That's a quirky story, if anything.
Yeah, yeah.
The quest, you know, it's like maybe that's a podcast series, you know, 10 episodes on the...
The guy Miller at Miller's Coffee's done a bit of research. And so as, what's the name, Burton, is the Wellington food historian guy as well.
Yeah,
I mean, I just haven't got a photograph of the blackboard with a date on it.
Hey, now, everyone, by the way, I've just finished a delicious flat white that Fraser made downstairs on the machine. And you just realised you did find sugar.
Yeah, I found some sugar.
Oh, good on you, mate. Yeah, yeah. It's beautiful. It's really lovely. So down to the bar, I mean, running a pub, people think that's a romantic thing to do, run a pub. What's the realities of setting up a pub and running a pub? What do you learn really quickly?
You learn a lot of things, but the first thing you learn is you've got to have multiple loads of skills.
Yeah.
So you've got to, you know, and managing staff is one of them, and ordering in the stock, keeping compliant, keeping abreast of what's sort of going on in the industry and all that.
And you trained to do none of this, right? You did it all based on your intuition and knowledge and picking up stuff yourself.
Absolutely. Yep. So, I had that job as a wine waiter in 78, and I had done dishes at the Cafe Bodega, Brooklyn Deli and Armadillo, and I've always had an interest in food. I remember when I was a kid, I used to bottle up at the local Foursquare and then get paid, and because I'd come from London, as a kid I might spend this money on, so I used to buy Danish camembert in a tin and a box of coffee bags and go home and sit there with mum and have a cup of coffee and some Danish cheese. Yeah. I remember Dad always moaning and grumbling, waiting for the next boat to come in so you get HP sauce.
Was there a focus? I don't remember a focus or there being food in the bar per se.
Nah.
You kept the cafe and the bar quite separate in that regard, right?
Yeah.
So you get into the bar, you get that space set up, and you said it used to be stables, so
the whole thing is 60 years. There's a big difference in those days, particularly between running a restaurant and running a bar. Running a restaurant's a lot harder than running a bar. And the requirements for food with your liquor license wasn't as stringent in those days as it is now. And so I could get away with pies and beer sticks and peanuts.
Which is kind of people what people want, chippies. The sort of bar you're in
anyway.
Yeah,
it is. But the
host responsibility
the
stuff
host
now.
The host responsibility wants hot food available. It's basically what it is pushing for is that all bars are more or less restaurants and bistros.
So you get on in there, and we're kind of built up to this with the other stuff you talked about with the learning about beer, being in the UK and so on. Was that the plan from the get-go to have curious beers in there compared to what was
on?
It was.
I went to Lion and said, I want to open this bar and I want to be able to put on some taps of Strongcroft as well as Steinlager and Waikato, and I just said nah. And then I went to DB, And they wanted to say, you know, can I please have export and Monteith's? And I got close to opening. I said, well, are you going to do this or not? Not really realising it wasn't actually that expensive to buy a regulator and the gas bottles and things. Everybody sort of thought it was some sort of mysterious thing.
Oh, I see. So I was going to ask about that. So the kind of duopoly the breweries had was this misperception that the equipment was some kind of sorcery that you couldn't set up yourself.
Because
the story I heard, a different version, is that they would basically strong-arm you and say, no, you're just having our beers or no beers.
Was there
a bit of that as well?
Yeah, they'll give you money
to
help with your setup.
Yeah.
But that sort of petered out once so many bars opened and set up and went under, because like once the licensing got deregulated, more and more people could get into it. And so for the big breweries, for the big breweries, it was a bit of a conundrum, especially when you have people like me turning up wanting to pour craft beer, you know, or other beers, or have a range of beers.
Yeah.
But normally, and they'd have a manager in a hotel or a motel, and they'd be like that, you know, the tenant landlord, and they'd just run a DB pub or they'd run a
Lion pub.
And all the bands used to go around from the big pubs which had accommodation,
yeah,
and get accommodation and food and paid.
Yeah.
So that's in the Halcyon days of the dudes and, yeah, you know, and all that sort of. And
Everything was Reineck.
And everything was, well, Reineck sort of came.
But they kind of, they were the, they were trying to be the music. They were trying to be the music brand, right?
Actually, I got involved with the Rock the Quota.
Yeah.
With Mark Cuby and the guys from Cardrake. What were they guys' name? Mark and, and the guy Barrett. Anyway, there's four of us. And so we were trying to promote a New Zealand music quota for radio. So we organised four concerts over 3 days. And because I was flacking with guys in TV, we got it all filmed. So I was watching it, and you had a TV3 camera go down, and the TVNZ camera come up to carry on shooting. It was all done sort of under semi-undercover. And we produced a 90-minute doco out of it. But out of that, I had a Filofax full of all the bands in New Zealand, virtually all the bands in New Zealand.
So Bodega's not booking bands at first. This is something that comes later.
No, we're just a cafe, and when we first opened, put a little stage in, and we had, I can't remember which Machination of the Six Folks it was on. It might have been the Brainchilds. Anyway, they played, and then it was obvious from then on I wanted to run a venue, and that was it. And then we got in a...
So to give us an idea, just quickly, Fraser, how many of these, you know, big brewery touring circuit pubs are there in Wellington at the time? There's like, you know, where else is there to play? Nowhere for a lot of the bands you're booking, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, because I wanted, you know, I was just been for Radioactive and I wasn't into blues based rock and roll. I wanted Flying Nun, I wanted indie, I wanted, you know. So that's basically because it was my taste in beer and my taste in music.
Good. That, you know, it worked, man. Job. It worked. Yeah.
I get to choose the beers, and I get to choose the bands, and I get to have free beer. And I just get it's for, you know.
Yeah.
I was in heaven. It was the best job a young man could ever have. But it was. And, you know, we're lucky because the rent was cheap, and learned everything off the hoof. And at the end of the old Bodega, it turned out that we had been receiving the rates demand for the building, and we'd be paying them. Which we thought, you know, you get the rates demand, you pay them. But it turned out the landlord had been paying them, so the council gave you back enough money to pay off all our debts.
No!
And we had $2,000 spare.
So you'd been unintentionally, like...
paying the rates.
But no, but you'd been, like, you basically had a stockpiling money,
Not realising it, and it turned out to be just as well.
And lucky...
covered
you know
all
what?
Our bills by $2,000.
That's so amazing. So when
each.
You moved down to Guzney later on...
Yeah. Then we had to borrow a whole lot of money to do that. And that was a little bit fraught, that site. It was just not really in the right place. It was a bit big.
We'll
it was
get,
okay
we'll,
to start with, but it, you know, Wellington didn't...
We've still got so much to talk about in the old place.
Okay, all right.
So, you know, pub culture at the time, like, I've thought often, I think the mythology of Bodega as a venue, rightly so, is the story that's told. And maybe secondary, you know, sort of second fiddle to that is the fact that you actually had a pub culture there when there weren't bands playing. And it's not really, or at least in my lifetime, not a big culture of that in New Zealand, like when you're in the UK or wherever.
Yeah. It wasn't the same. It was like the pub culture in New Zealand was basically, a jug and jugs and pints for men.
And there was like the sort of public bar was
public
almost
bar
scorned. It was almost a class system. It was scorned by others.
And the women used to drink.
Yeah.
And then there was the lounge bar, which probably would have
But there was, a, there was a conception that public bars were like dens of iniquity and kind of dangerous places.
Now we're talking, leaning into the sort of history of New Zealand licenses.
Yeah. So, you know, for you, sorry, I cut you off there with that. Yeah. But yeah, you did, like early on, you established a local pub, which was, I don't think, was a common thing in town at the time at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, partly because of anthropology was that I knew that I wanted to have a good local culture. So we used to do free food on Friday nights. So we'd do like, you know, chili mussels and frankfurters and bread and stuff like that. And that sort of brought people in.
Great.
Got the locals coming in. And then as the band thing got more and more bigger, then of course there had to be that difficult transition between local.
I remember being there a couple of times in those afternoons.
Yeah, it happened about 9, and it was always a bit of tension.
Sound checking with a rugby game on the telly.
Yeah, and sound checking prior, you know, trying to get people to sound check before the place opened,
yeah,
because the locals just did not want to have to listen to somebody, you know.
But so, it hadn't occurred to me till after the fact, you know, doing my wee bit of research before I came and chatted to you, that at least there, going in and sound checking wasn't a huge rigmarole of multiple takes, because you just had a vocal PA. So it was just plug in your amp, make it make sound, make all the sounds fit together, get out. Well, not get out.
The whole
go
room
have a beer
was basically
or,
an onstage sound.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, you used to get bands who want to bring in their Marshall quad box and want it mic'd up. So you see, you put the mic in front of it, but not putting
you'd be able to
not,
hear it. You'd be able to hear it down like...
Yeah. Just put them there, you know, use all the dead mics and put them in front of the quad boxes. It's like, you know, mate. I mean, one time I think it was Dead Flowers turned up with a PA out of the Auckland Town Hall, part of it, you know. So, what?
Yeah,
it was always an issue. And as time went on, because originally I had an overlight from where the stables end and across the sort of courtyard, and of course... the noise complaints were coming in thick and fast, so I just that slowly but surely got covered in, and I'd get sort of luckily I had actually done a course in audio engineering in the late 80s, and so I knew a little bit about soundproofing, so that slowly helped, but it was always that tension between the neighbourhood and the bands. And it was funny, one election, I can't remember, was the one, the first one with MMP. And
96, I reckon.
Was it?
Yeah, because I think it might have been.
Yeah.
I was at uni doing political studies, so that's why I remember
it. So I got all the people who were standing to come and talk to the bar on a Friday night.
Yeah.
And so that sort of worked, and it was entertaining, and apparently Richard Prebo was really nervous about doing it, you know, in the Arrow Valley. Anyway,
Mung Bean Valley.
Yeah. So he ended up actually being elected because, you know, Wellingtonians are pretty shrewd voters. So they put him in. And the good thing about him as an MP, like, I could ring him and say, look, man, I'm getting hammered here for noise complaints. So he'd ring up Blumsky and have a go at him. So then it'll quiet down. And then and I'll ring up the MP, local MP, and he'd ring up Blumsky and quiet down. So, yeah, it was also meant that I couldn't really go late.
Yeah.
Although, having said that, I used to get late licences to fire for things like, you know, Roots Foundation and some of the...
Because you're just sort of, early venue for a lot of, you know, what became a whole culture into itself, right?
Yeah.
I guess, broadly speaking, kind of dance music culture.
So it used to be Usha and his brother used to come in and do hip-hop.
Yeah.
Early on, so it was like the really early hip-hop, you know. And then... we had the Roots Foundation and Toasty and other guys. So it was sort of like the whole posse of DJs guys sort of coming along. And it was, you know, and then, I mean, then a couple of other venues opened up and snaffled that sort of part of the market up. But yeah, and then there was always that tension I had between live music and dance music.
But yeah, also because back then, again, not only preaching to the choir, but a lot of the audience listening to this will know that there was much more of a division back then. It's much more natural now for a band to have an electronic element or a
break that down, really.
That's right. And look, you know, I don't know if there's a statute of limitations here, but Mark Hubie, said, when I was chatting to him about talking to you, said in a constructive way about yourself that you were never afraid to bend the rules. But you just talked about the licensing stuff of that, so I don't know if how much you want to tell us.
Now it's like the poacher turning gamekeeper.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
You just try and, so you can't say a lot, but you just try and do what you could to get stuff done, which there was a lot. I mean, it's not unique. I've talked to a few people about this, you were in a culture where you could do that then. There's just so much more red tape. I mean, speaking of dance culture, remember those huge events Leon Baldock was putting on at the sheds on the waterfront? Like, you couldn't do that now. The police would turn up and shut you down within, or some organisation would turn up and have a problem with something,
I mean, it was kind of a really good period, the early mid-90s, because it was that transition to the sort of cafe culture, more urbaneness.
And a lot of other businesses like fashion, there was a whole lot of stuff that was popping on up at the same time kind of supported each other.
Well, people making clothes, we had people started making hats, the whole thing was sort of getting really creative and explosive and getting more sort of, we're so far away, but so many people have been overseas that they wanted to do what they'd seen in Europe and other places. So the population had reached that sort of critical mass.
It's actually in the article I told you I've written about ACTIV, which is coming out in January, actually, in Audio Culture, so this month. I kind of, again, trying to squeeze so much, 4 decades into that. I do talk about that period in the 90s, like you kind of described it. How's this? I've got a nice, there's a gentle way of asking you a question about pushing the rules. what was the capacity of the venue?
The capacity.
And then I'm going to ask a follow-on question.
Okay? I can't remember what I declared the capacity as. I think it was something like 140.
Okay. Now listen to this wording. Now, how many could you squeeze in there if you needed to?
I think Gerald got about 200 in for the Headlocker Hole.
Wow. Right.
It was just too packed. It was
And you see steam coming off the walls outside.
When Supergroup played, they played 3 gigs and they first turned up and none of them smoked and they were too young to drink. And by the third gig, they're all smoking, they've all got girlies, and they're all drinking. But the room, going through, and the walls were actually just dripping with condensation because everybody was dancing.
You were as much a host and in the truest sense of the word as you were a businessman. But something occurs to me now: if you've got 200 people in there, you probably can't turn over your bar because no one can get there to get a drink.
Used to call bar lock. Get to the point where people can't get to
the bar.
And in those days, also it was people would hang around after the gig or try to get in before the gig and be in the bar, and that was really good because then the band would finish, you put a DJ on and people would hang around, the band would hang around and it'd be a really cool vibe. People slowly dripped off, but then when the wine, and then in 1999 when beer went into the supermarkets, that was like, particularly beer, that was the beginning of the preloading culture, and that sort of ended that sort of hanging around the bar.
And that huge difference, and I've thought about this when I lived in Australia, there's a slight difference I'll get to, but that obviously that huge difference in price between a glass of beer now and a six pack or a dozen in the supermarket. Whereas at least
one in a six pack, the same price.
Right. So when I lived in Melbourne, I noticed that their wet tax on their off license is actually quite a bit higher. So the difference between a box of beer at the bottle shop and in a bar over there is not as wide a gap. I don't know, I just see it as a bigger challenge here because off-license booze is so cheap comparatively.
We're now looking at down the barrel of minimum price per standard drink.
Yeah.
My son, who's just got back from Otago, always talks about the golden ratio, which is one drink per dollar. So if you can buy something that's got, six standard drinks in for $6...
I see, this is the young student take on...
The golden ratio.
Well, that's a whole other conversation I worry about, is that what's come along that I don't think was around as much then is really low-grade booze with low-grade soda for, like, really cheap. I don't think someone hopped up on an $8 bottle of Guarana, a fake vodka and cola's going to do anyone any favours, you know?
That sort of came in with the guy with Ursic and the independent breweries.
Now, you had some really, obviously, eclectic shows over the years.
Oh, yeah.
And, God, that's a podcast episode in itself, Fraser. But was there, like, right, so the story I read is you go and you see, the story I read, I'm kind of being with people who come in and done it with you, it's like you go and you see if there's a gap on your calendar to talk to you about how it's going to work, da-da-da-da. Now, the broader brushstroke is, was there a method to that madness in terms of, like, were you thinking about, well, I've got this kind of band Tuesday in March, so I better have something more dubby or more rocky or more indie?
There was always a problem or an issue, was that you had to keep it booked at least 6 weeks in advance.
Yeah.
The problem being that some touring bands would give you really short notice, so you end up in a position where you're going to have to bump bands, which normally would be Friday or Saturday, because that's when the touring bands wanted to come through.
And they might have spent their meagre amount of money on the budget on their little posters. And
I used to do the basic publicity, so I'd do the little, was that a little magazine thing?
Engine package? There were two of them, yeah.
The package. Yeah. I'd advertise that for them. I'd do a poster run, and I'd do Radioactive, and then they could do any extra themselves.
So back to the booking the calendar. Sorry, I took
so
you off.
So I'd try to get 6 weeks, in, at least 6 weeks in advance is usually more.
Yeah.
But then there would be that. Then you'd always try, and you want to have big bands Friday, Saturday, obviously.
Yeah.
But if I could get a touring band that was big name to play Wednesday, Thursday,
yeah,
that would be even better. Then yeah, I'd definitely have a good week.
Yeah, that's right.
And and then you sort of want to have something that's going to pull more than just, you know, pull something on Tuesday, Wednesday. So I used to do comedy, poetry.
Beats on Bubbles for years, which I did for a while for you before Shannon did it for Shannon did it for years. But I think I did one of the early incarnations. I think Liam,
genius that was.
I think Liam. I think you might have started getting Liam doing it, and then he went on his OE, and then you gave it to me, and then I took off from Wellington. Then I think Shannon did it for Donkey's years.
Yeah, yeah. So that was. So I thought, oh my God, how am I going to get people? You know, get.
$2 Lindows, folks.
Yeah, because you know, $2 Lindows
or
whatever the cheapest champagne I can get. And of course, remember the champagne bubbles glasses are only 150.
Yeah.
So you're going to get five per bottle, and so I'm going to get $10 back. So if I get my bubbles for like $5 or $6,
yes, yeah, that's what it comes down to, folks.
Even, but where you made your money was when you stopped between eight. It was between was.
I can't remember, mate. I think it was so
10
long
and
ago.
12 or 8 and whatever. Anyway, so, and then people would be half fizzed up and chatting, and then they'd stay and you do a good turnover. I mean, having some employer coming, who it was, ring me and say, can you stop that bloody Beats and Bubbles? All my staff are coming hungover every Wednesday.
And globally, folks, I've got to say, well, at least the places I've been, if you can get something happening in your venue or your whatever on a Tuesday, Tuesday is the day where you're just trying to pay. The bottom line is you're trying to pay to keep the fridges running on Tuesday,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, you know? Power bill was huge when you're running chill rooms and beer fridges and the PA's got to be on the whole time because you can't just turn the PA on.
Yeah.
You know, so the PA's on the whole time. So you've got a huge power bill. And you're always looking for something that will bring, you know. So there's always sort of, in my mind, there's sort of like pulling bands and holding bands. So a good jazz band's a holding band. People come in, oh, this is all right, and they'll stay. So you tend to pay them out of the till. Whereas a pulling band, the ones who are going to bring enough people. So bands used to ring up and say, oh, yeah, we want to book so-and-so. We want $500. And I go, well, how many people are you going to pull? And they go, oh, 100, 150. I said, oh, put $5 on the door. You'll easily make that. Yeah. So that's how the sort of the door thing happened. Yeah. Because the first year, some cunning musician said, oh, yeah, just give us cash out of the till. So I was doing that, and then we got a tax department inspection, and luckily it was the guy who was just retiring. He said, listen, you probably owe us $22,000 in tax. I said, well, I might as well shut now, you know. He says, look, if you from now on don't pay them out of the till, if you do, you've got to take withholding tax and work out
got to be legit with it. Yeah,
you've got to be legit. I said, fine. But he said, if you don't have anything to do with the door, it's up to the bands to sort their own tax, so they're a contract. Yep. So that's what we did.
Yeah, that's a great system. Yeah,
And it's a lot simpler.
Yeah,
and it keeps your overheads down because you constantly wanted to keep your overheads down. I remember when the bar finally closed, the list of people who were being paid by the bar was huge. It was mind-boggling how much.
Cleaners,
cleaning product. There was three bills just to keep the fire alarm system.
Glassware
going.
Suppliers. Promo. I get it.
It was horrific. There's stuff I didn't even know I was paying. And so, and that's why it's so expensive to buy a beer in a bar.
No, totally, absolutely. And for the fact that you're coming in and sitting somewhere that isn't your house and doing something different, and that's the whole...
I mean, you have a licence, you've got to have a kitchen that's licensed, you've got to have a food person, you've got to pay for their food certificate, you've got to pay for your staff's manager's certificates.
And that red tape felt like it got more... It got more and more. Bureaucracy gone mad.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, some of it was worthy, health and safety stuff, but a lot of it's just...
Against the no-smoking law.
I think when rules start to restrict creativity and innovation, and that outweighs a health and safety concern or whatever, then that's just kind of shit.
that sort of changed, and that's when that started changing in the 90s.
So talk about, I wanted to get to this, but let's just go, you've mentioned it, You rallied against the smoking law. All I'll say is discuss.
Duncan Garner was working at TV3, and TV3's studio was just sort of across the way, and those guys used to come in and drink. So they came in, when it was first meeting, came in and said, they're going to make smoking in bars illegal, and at the moment they're proposing 50-50. You know, he said, you know what, Fraser, I reckon you should take 50-50.
50, what does that mean, 50-50?
Half the bar smoking, half the bar non-smoking.
Gotcha.
Okay, but unfortunately, Bruce Robinson, I can't remember what he's doing now, he was the head of the Hotel Association. He was confident that we could beat it, but I was a bit worried because he was a non-smoker. Anyway, so I ended up being sort of like the semi-default spokesperson because those guys would always come and ask me about blah, 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 blah. And as time went on, it got, you know, the restrictions got worse and worse, and you had things like Stevie Chadwick going, oh, but, you know, bars, they close all the time, because you know that there is a high correlation between people who drink and people who smoke.
And people, let's face it, went out and drunk and smoked in tandem more then than they do now. So
Yeah. I mean, I don't smoke now, and I don't, you know, I'm glad of the law, but it did change the whole dynamic. So when the band's playing and it's half time between bands, everybody goes out
instead cigarette. Of buying a drink.
So the next band goes, well, do we start now?
Yeah.
You know, and then the beer game in the supermarkets, so the turn, I went from like 6 pints a visit down to 2.5, 3.
Yeah.
And it just really made it really hard. And then we had more competition and, you know.
And also a lot of people have spoke about how generous a booker you were with like things like riders and a few drinks afterwards and this and the other. And yeah. I'd imagine that meant that Fraser had to change his natural inclination as a human being and a publican.
Yeah, it became more and more difficult to be hospitable.
Yeah, more and more Granville, even though you don't... What's his name? Arkwright. Even though you don't want to be.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you couldn't shout the beer ban some beers. You couldn't, you know... And you got two accountants. Orientated.
And so how far did your involvement in lobbying against the tobacco rules go? Like, did you speak on any, you know, were you asked to submit?
I was on the TV quite a lot, and I spoke to the select committee, all to no avail. So I kind of have a little bit of sympathy for the anti-vaxxers, but not a lot.
But so your gist was obviously not like, smoking's great, we should do it forever. It was more like, these rules are like... have come on sort of a bit too thick and fast for our industry to be able to adjust to them.
Well, yes, and yeah, but, well, yeah. It was like all the bars were set up with smoking.
Yeah.
Which all the bars had to change to have smoking areas, and people had to walk through the smoking areas to get into the bars. And it meant that there's a lot of places around that had to cobble it together.
Yeah.
So when the virus first hit, I thought, well, this is... If I was in hospitality now, I'd be saying to the fellow publicans, like, if you can get out now without losing your house...
Yeah, get out.
Get out.
Yeah.
And then the sites that are sorted and do have a kitchen, do have a proper smoking area, they should be preserved. But there's a lot of them around that don't have a kitchen, don't have a proper smoking area.
Is it true that tobacco companies started quietly dropping coin on helping certain like bars adjust stuff? I think maybe that was an Australian thing.
Yeah, and they may have done it. I mean, I never got... I used to have cigarettes behind the bar, but that was just fraught. I'd smoke them, staff smoked them, people would smoke them and say, I got a cigarette machine. And you'd make hardly anything out of it anyway. But it was just public convenience. We used to shut up 3 just to get a pack of cigarettes and go home. So, you know.
Nights that stick. So, again, you know, it's sort of like asking someone their favourite kid or a movie or whatever, insert thing here. But, you know, nights that stick out to you, the good, the bad and the mad, you know, particular.
No, it's all a big blur. I mean, I certainly had my favourite bands.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like... But there were so many of them. We had some great gigs, and it was good to meet, you know, people.
Is it one of those things where you, in hindsight, wish you'd kept a diary so you could know every date who played when? I think that'd be an amazing keepsake.
There is one that has been done off the things, but that there's a lot of other bands that play that we didn't capture.
And
no description of the gigs, because a lot of times so-and-so might have played, we don't know who the support bands were.
Yeah. You know? Man, that's a project for some internet nerds to put together.
It won't be in the internet because...
Where you'd have to do it collaboratively, right? Just everyone kind of pitching in their memories. They've done it with lineups of old festivals and stuff
I mean, obviously we've got the kernel of that. We got, you know, Dave McLennan, but we got it. I don't know where it is.
So before we move down the road to the new venue, you were very hands-on, right? So in that, like, what nights did you have off when the bar was open? Like,
I try to have a, you know, because then I was...
Because you had a young family.
Yeah, I had a young family, so I needed to get time off.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was tricky, really tricky, because, you know, your band will ring up and say, and can we have so and so a date? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you have a sound person? Yeah, yeah, yeah. If they turn up, oh, who's your sound person? And that's another night I'd have to stay. And if you're staying until one.
So you'd be the sound guy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And then you'd end up having a beer. Next thing you know, the birds are tweeting and you're getting home. It's like, oh, God. Yeah. And so, yeah, I spent too many late nights probably in the end of the day there. But the problem with hospitality, if you're not there, things can go awry.
That's right.
You have to have faith in your staff
and trust.
Did get burned a few times.
Yeah,
but you know, that's just life.
I remember this is an anecdote that did happen, and it's you'll see the humor. And I remember when you were obviously thinking about trying to you know hand on Bodega at some stage, and I was doing Beats and Bubbles a few weeks in a row, that you were kind of talking to me about the idea of, like, you know, maybe like something along the lines of you could take this on or whatever. And then I'm like, Fraser's talked to me about like maybe taking on the bar. And then I talked to someone about a week later, they go, he says that to everyone at the end of the night at the moment.
By the end of it, things started getting...
I thought I was anointed. It was like, look, we finished the night.
Getting really hard. Yeah. I had a young family. I wasn't that young anymore, and you kind of need to be young to be running a venue. And I was, after 16 years in the end, but after about 13, 14 years, I was just tired, wrung out, and I needed a break. And
16 years and 4 months, 91 to 2007.
Right.
That's Bodega sounds I've got written right. here, yeah. And then so we'll quickly go down the road, then we'll talk about Tuatara. I am assuming I wasn't in Wellington at the time, but you must have moved because the whole bypass, ass, et cetera, campaign ended up in favour of the bypass going through.
It was fraught from the word go, and I stupidly turned down Dransfield House for a dollar. So no.
But, Dransfield House?
It was the original mayor's house next to the
hotel. They offered you that for a dollar to move your bar there? Yeah. To actually own the land as well?
The whole thing for a dollar.
Goodness,
so they could say that there's some... And I stupidly said, no, I won't do it. But I needed a lot of work on it. It was a constant sort of battle when you had the anti-motorway people, and you know, that were really keen on me staying where I am and da-da-da-da-da. But you sort of knew all the way through that sooner or later it was going to have to happen, because Wellington needed it really.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of fraught. So I knew it was going to happen. It was just a matter of when. And you know, it was good for the city in some ways, that there was all these old buildings that people could start up, young people could start up businesses in for cheap rent and cut their teeth.
Yep. And there was, like, you know, I just don't want to bring up old anxiety, because you know, I feel like you've been quite anxious about that. You're saying that period where you've been a public in a long time, but then you actually moved to a bigger venue and got a book, you know. So were you re-energized by that, or were you more like, oh,
well,
God.
I had a year off, and I thought, well, yeah, I mean, I was always getting bar lock.
Oh, so there was no Bodega for a year before you moved?
We were building the new one.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there was the what's his name? The bathhouse hadn't been that much.
Tim?
No, this is before Tim.
Stephen.
Steve was running the bathhouse.
Subcard Steve.
Yeah. And Steve Upton, and he was booking it, and I knew the the bands better. And then Paddy Moran started booking for Tema, who knew the bands as well as me, if not better. So that meant I had a more stiffer competition for gigs.
Yeah.
And we both held the same amount of people, about on or about 500. And, of course, I had the big pillar in the middle. And so, that coincided with beer going to the supermarket, and the no smoking law just made it tougher and tougher and tougher. And
but bigger venue, probably getting bigger international bands and that sort of stuff. And then we'll get to the end of the Bodega period, but you handed it off to someone else for its last few years, didn't you?
Yeah, Murray Heppel came back, and he had a lot of experience with bands, and so he could do it where he would get the band, promote the band, and make help do the old-fashioned British way, make money out of the door, which is sort of different to how I was doing it.
Why do you call it the British way?
Well, I don't know. That's kind of how they work over there. You pay, in some places, you pay to be on the be on the lineup.
Yeah,
you know, to promote yourself, which is, you know, and it, so it was sort of like the inverse of what I had been doing.
Yep.
Whereas you take the door, I'll take the bar.
Gotcha.
But because the bar had dropped so much, the biggest turnover, Murray reckoned that the biggest turnover he ever had was the first night that he took over, when, you know, when I had some metal bands, I think it was, from the Hut playing, and we, you know, did a reasonable turnover, and apparently that was the most he did. But he ran it out. I don't know how he did it. He ran it another way, and he managed to keep going for quite some time, which I was always impressed by.
I came down there once. I was back in Wellington, and it wasn't even gig time or night time. I think we bumped into you and went down. It was good that I got to have a look at it there, the newer space. It was while I used to run it. So it's listener question time, Fraser. The last guest I did this to said, are these real? And I'm like, they sure are. And you'll probably recognise the names here. So P. May asks. Ask him how many noise abatement notices he was served. At one point, he was talking about wallpapering his office with them.
Correct. I used to get so many noise abatement notices. Yeah. There was enough to cover the.
You knew the name of every noise control officer.
Frank. At the stage, they just come and hand us the thing, and we go, and we shut it down. And I stopped having bands after midnight. Because it was sort of semi-residential, so that sort of...
Folks, for those who don't know, it's the delicate art of not getting to the point where any equipment is seized.
That's correct.
Isn't it?
So if you get to that point, that's you stop, you know, you just have to.
I've had someone high on my turntables, then the next week, my turntables are where? I've got to do what? Okay, B. Tilly asks, what were the first bands he booked? Remember that.
I remember we had the Crawlbelly Creeps, who were the last rockabilly band.
Yeah.
We had some of the...
Brainchild,
some of the last machinations of the Six Faults. We had the Bilgees, Bilge Festival.
Yeah,
great. We had the Guardian Angels.
Great.
We had...
Nick's from B. Tilly. What was the most popular... This is very specific questions. What was the most popular dish on the cafe menu?
Jumbo breakfast.
Great. Yeah, we talked about that. The big deep fry. Yeah, great. Fantastic.
Four sausages, two eggs, jumbo mix.
What year was the best? I think he means the bar. What year was the best business? What year did the best business?
Probably somewhere around 95, 96, I thought.
Yeah. What, if anything, does he miss most from that period? That means you, Fraser.
As I said before, you know, choosing the bands, choosing the beer, and being sort of like, you know... Having a public lounge, but also being sort of like people, being sort of like an attention, centre of attention, or being a somebody.
But that's an honest answer. Like, not a lot of people would say that, and that is a thing, right?
Yeah.
Now, L. Ryan asks, and by the way, this JP is not... The JP, I don't think that you and I would think of in terms of JP. But let's try this. JP was a regular at Bar Bodega and a formidable character. When I ran gigs there, meaning Liam, Liam ran gigs there, he asked Fraser about security. Fraser suggested that if there was trouble, to ask JP, and JP would assist unruly customers towards other premises. Who's JP?
Uh, J- JP was one of the regulars who I'd known.
A cantankerous varsity. Old...
Yeah.
I'm just guessing.
He was one of the bar's daily acolyte. He used to drink what we call JP's snake bite. It was in a 750ml glass.
Oh, boy.
And it had Broford's Hooker, which is 7.5, and the St. Andrew's cider in it, which was 8.5.
Yeah, so he's mixing to a wine kind of...
Well, yeah, because you've got to remember, alcohol with bubbles, the bubbles assist the absorption, so it's getting up towards the intake level of a low alcohol wine. So, JP was a regular feature of the bar.
But it's sounding like the way Liam framed it, that JP was actually quite handy because he would be on the side of the bar.
Never threw anybody out. He'd glare at a few people for sure. He might have done, but I can't remember it.
And, oh, God, this might be a big one to answer, but just a few thoughts on it. People might forget you had a record label at the time as well to do with the bar.
That's right, yeah.
And you put out Solid Pyrite Hits, the first Stereo Bus album, and then I looked into this further, and the short and the cinematic albums. That just sounds like a whole lot of extra work, Fraser.
Dave Pine's solo album. Well, it was just that... Yeah, I had been trained as an audio engineer, and I was doing the mixing, and I was talking to people, and it just sort of seemed like the next thing to do.
But before there was an industry like there was now, folks, sort of like not as easy to indie put together an indie label.
That was part of it. It was very hard for bands to get a deal. You know, if they were bands that didn't appeal to Roger at Flying Nun, then there wasn't. For indie bands, there wasn't really much else. There was,
Andrew Tolley?
Andrew Tolley's label. There was a couple around.
Angela Means did a release or two.
The Art Cafe did some albums.
Come back to the mic.
The Art Cafe did some as well. It's just that there wasn't actually that many places bands. Yeah. And it also had the added... As it panned out, bonus, so that made bands want to play the bar even more in case
it got signed.
Yeah.
Okay, here's another one. Well, I love how small Wellington is in our community, essentially. O. Brooke White, Brooke White asks, ask him when he's going to come back to Vinyl Club again. I don't even know what that's about.
Oh, that's, so Jim Scott and Ollie and other guys get together and play vinyl. So it was kind of cool. Once I lost the bar, I used to get it was kind
just
of
get nice. Out and enjoy being a punter and playing some music.
Vinyl.
Great, you do.
Unfortunately, I didn't manage to keep any of my Technics 1200s. They went with the bar, but
there's always time.
Yeah.
There's two more here. S King says, "Can you shout the chorus of this at him repeatedly, please? Bell Bottoms."
Bell Bottoms. Yeah.
Okay, so that must have been a favourite at the bar. Lastly,
the Blues Explosion.
M. O'Leary says, "Send him my love, miss him and his darling brother Callum big time."
All right, Callum's back for Christmas.
Great. Yeah. Okay. So I think we talk a bit about Tuatara now because that's an interesting story as well. I won't keep you much longer.
Film archive, the Bodega.
No, there's a documentary about Bodega.
The documentary.
Okay, I'll have a look.
That's sort of half and half. So having my beer epiphany in 1982 and managed to get the position where I had 2 dB taps and 2 of my own taps, I went on to put on another stand with some of beer.
Yeah.
And then I went on and just didn't put on another stand. And then I put on the next one, the dB rec comes and goes... It's my dad.
You want to take the call?
Yeah. Hey, Dad, how are you? Okay. Cheers, Dad. Bye.
Oh, that's lovely that the old man's still around.
Yeah, we're just watching the TDNZ news and there's somebody growing coffee up in Northland, which I kind of knew anyway, but yeah.
Right.
When you go and do that? So back to the beer. So craft, when I first got going...
Okay, sit down by the mic.
That's right. So when I when I first got going,
it's like herding cats.
It wasn't craft beer. It was called microbreweries.
Yeah,
and there was Strongcroft in out the hut. The likes of Brophy's. There was
Gisborne Gold.
Gisborne Gold. There was Silver Fern. There was the Shakespeare was doing beers.
I said Emerson before, but I think that's Australian.
Which one?
Emerson's.
Emerson's was Dunedin.
Dunedin, yeah, that's what we used to get up at Active on Friday nights.
Yeah, yeah. Emerson's Bookbinder came out to like 93, 94, and it's the first one. It was a really fruity beer splitter, and you could say to somebody, "This is an ale, and this is a lager."
Yeah.
So a lot of the time was spent teaching people about craft or microbrew or craft beer, and having and also supporting craft breweries, and so it's another sort of love of mine. So we started off and we had Strongcroft, we had Silver Fern, I had cider, pretty much had a cider virtue from the word go. And there's all these things about, oh, you can't sell snake bites, it makes people go crazy, barley, which is just bollocks. And so there was a core of the original microbrewers, and then as time went on, things changed, and most of them were lager, dark, and draft, but only a few were actually doing the actual craft beer styles, like the styles of beer, and that slowly changed. And when the Emerson's Bookbinder came out, I could tell you, this is a lager, this is an ale. And so as time went on, the craft industry started to move and get better. I met Carl Vaster. He was brewing at the Parrot and Jigger, and he'd bring in his, get their IPA, which was really good. And Carl was talking about, setting up a brewery. And it sort of, I got him to brew a Belgian wit beer, which was just after the, was it called Leuven had opened. So they had Hoegaarten on tap.
Yeah.
And so we brewed that and we got a bronze at the Beer Awards. And then eventually, sort of by the end of 1999, we sort of got, Carl got going. We all put chipped in money and we were brewing at Ricky Arangi in a shed with a small well coming out of the ground.
And you were still a publican then, because he was supplying you and the malt house, wasn't he? That was the business deal.
Yeah, that was a sort of the classic craft business model, a couple of publicans and a brewery.
Great.
Brewer get together.
Yeah.
Talk about a convincing, but Malt House got into it and it was great. I mean, we had the only two craft beer bars in Wellington was the Malt House and Bodega. And then there's Bar Edward opened up towards the end of that as well. And then, so we had guaranteed taps, so we didn't have to have a bottling plant.
Yeah.
And so that meant guaranteed turnover, guaranteed literage, and it just grew from there. And then the whole industry just went ape.
Yeah.
Much the same as coffee and cafes went ape. So the whole of New Zealand culture was moving and shifting, and I got into it, and it was part and parcel of it in many ways, in helping shift it.
I've always thought there's great strengths, but also there can be drawbacks in being the pioneer or the pioneers. Like often getting in first, it can be good aspects to that and not so great aspects to that. Do you relate to that?
It was always. But one of the things I did do was like I charged pretty much the same price for all beers.
Yeah.
So the people who were drinking DB products were basically subsidising the people drinking the other products. So everything was $3.50 to start with. And then as things went on and prices changed, some had to be dearer than others. But so I was there promoting Tuatara beer, so I had all the Tuatara taps, and I'd do go out and do beer tastings and stuff like that. So when I lost the bar, I went to the brewery and I used to do staff training. I spent a time beer line cleaning. And used to do the tours around the...
You were the tour guide, that's right, when I came out there.
So I've got a huge memory and knowledge of...
You would have been a great tour guide, I reckon.
I quite enjoy it. Try and make it as humorous as possible. And that's another one that got sort of a little bit nobbled by health and safety, but you get that.
Yeah.
So the Tuatara... we started off like craft beer, wanting to recreate or reinterpret the classic beer styles. And then as time went on, it became more about, I won't use the word adulterating, but using new ingredients in the beer. And I don't, I mean, I'm down with it, and I do like...
What are you insinuating here, to cut costs or something like that?
No. It's a lot of breweries now make beer using all kinds of weird and wacky stuff.
Right, okay. Yeah, okay. We're more in the science lab than in the field here.
Yeah. And the period I went through, we were still just trying to claw back the styles of beer that had been lost. It was
DB made for thousands of years.
DB and Lye wanted to get down to three colours of lager.
Yeah.
And pretty much had done by 1990.
Yeah.
And so then when craft got going, the first response was to bring in international lagers. So they brought in Stella.
Yeah, that was the, it was the era I sort of came on up and was going out. Yeah, Beck's and Heineken and Stella.
So they're bringing
in
international lagers to try and suppress craft.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah. But it was just the whole mentality, the alternative thing like that, and the creative people, we just... It's just not going to work for us. It worked for the corporate, but it ain't going to work for us.
Now, can I just... this is new knowledge to me. I haven't thought about this. Is the three colours of lager... I'm guessing that's an ease of production thing. Like, they don't want the fuckery of trying to make 14 different beers.
So if you've got a huge...
So it's a Coca-Cola kind of model, isn't it? Of just...
And you're just using one lager yeast.
Yeah.
You can just change the malt that you're using.
Got it.
And you can just basically have three colours, lager, draft, and black.
Yeah.
And...
So you're just a headache for them.
Absolutely. And now, look, now they've all bought craft breweries.
Yeah.
And what was happening, because when we got more and more of the supermarket shelves were getting turned over to craft beer because people were interested in it and they could sell them. And so the mainstream was losing real estate on the shelves in the supermarket. And what had been premium or to them became standard, and what was standard became budget. So all their beers sort of took a drop down, and then craft started, you now buy bottles of craft beer in the supermarket of $10,
$12, $13. I tell you, when I had a moment with that, this is years after lots of different beer had been in the supermarket for a while, good old Wellington, I was back down here, this feels like only a few years ago, and I was at that New World in town, and I was like, this is the most exotic, this is the widest range of beers I think I've seen anywhere bar a couple of bars in my life. The one down on the waterfront, the mid-city one. They had a lot.
New World were really good because they sort of embraced it.
Yeah.
And cider as well, because cider's really come a long way since then as well.
And just to backtrack a wee bit, because I like this anecdote, it wasn't originally called Tuatara, but you came up with that name cashing up at the bar. Is that true? With the five cent pieces?
$2 coin.
I think the five cent piece. I think it's
five cent piece. That's right.
I think that's you don't even have five cent piece anymore. It's a great name.
Yeah, yeah. And we just use it as like, and also because it's not Iwi specific, but it's still a Maori word. So that's one of the things I sort of knew from when I'm studying Maori, and they got that contemporary issues that ownership of
Actually down the track with the company became an issue right when they tried to trademark. Didn't they try and trademark?
Don't know
a Maori phrase. Anyway. Related to that is cost of production. I'd imagine.
Is that a courier? That's all right. There's actually a lot more to talk about craft beer than that way you can be the quality. So it's a craft. So.
Go on.
When I was at varsity, doing my thing, I was flatting with Dominic Kelly.
Right.
He used to run the student bar, who then ended up with Hashi Kazaki.
Yeah.
After I left the bar.
Yeah.
So the two protagonists of craft beer in Wellington was Grant Jones at Regional Wines and myself. And we were sort of pushing the thing along. So Grant was used to, when I was getting Gisborne Gold, and I was getting needed so much of it, that I went and saw Grant and said, look, I don't know how much a keg you're going to have to charge, but can I get the beer delivered to you? So then he started getting the craft beers in and putting them in Regis.
Yeah.
And then I could get them delivered because my chill room was tiny. You know, so, and then we had the whole kerfuffle with Max, where in those days, one of the things.
Come back into the mic.
One of the things was that it was very expensive, the price of a keg.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get them into the country, but BB and Lion had loads of them. So there's always this, you know, people used to use their kegs.
Yeah.
And so Max, when I first got them on tap, said, "Don't you dare ever use my kegs for anything else." Anyway, this Christmas came and I didn't have enough kegs to send up to to Gisborne. I needed 12 kegs to get me through the Christmas period. So I sent up half a dozen of their kegs and a whole lot of DB ones. Jeff, God bless him, rang up Max and said, "Oh, Fraser sent up half dozen of your kegs. Is that okay? I fill them and send them back." So they immediately chop off my supply.
Oh, he accidentally dobbed you in?
Yeah. So they chopped off my supplies, had to grovel and scrape and send them to them. And then not long after, a couple of months later, Amon, the bar manager, accidentally sent down a Strongcroft keg, which was also these black rubber ones.
Yeah.
Fitchers, and they chopped me off that. And I thought, that's a bit thing. And then I went, okay, fuck, I'll go without Max. And then all of a sudden, Max turns up on tap at the new craft beer bar, the Malt House.
Oh, right.
So there's a little bit of skullduggery going on there.
Yeah.
But that was funny.
All's fair in love and war.
That's right.
So to the bottles, I was going to mention, you know, production costs are always a big consideration. And those bottles are fucking cool. They still are.
They're still good.
And so obviously, whose innovation was that? It's a natural move from Tuatara.
That was the marketing guys. But I can remember saying to Carl,
but am I right that makes the production cost that much more for those?
No, because you have to be in a position where you're going to buy a million a year.
Yeah.
Which we were.
Great.
And that was, and I think that was just before.
So you call the shots at the bottle manufacturer once you hit a million units a year?
Yeah. They wouldn't make your mold for you unless you guarantee you're going to buy that many.
Yeah.
But I remember saying to Carl, how come our beer is so much? He said, look, it's I think it was like $1.74 before we put the beer in for the cap, the label, the bottle.
That's insane.
The box and the outer.
Really? It was like, that's crazy.
Yeah. And that's why, because you didn't have production scale.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and as you get bigger, then you can get, you can get your own bottle made and it's cheaper than buying the ones from ABC. Yeah. So, yeah, there's lots of machinations.
So you're sort of saying a punt was taken there that paid off with that kind of...
Yeah, I know. We had got to the point where we were actually doing pretty well and we were making quite a lot of beer. And the two guys at Double Click or Double Fish, wherever they were, they said, why don't you get your own bottle? And I thought, And so we did it and it worked.
Yeah.
It worked really well.
Yeah.
And it's still working really well.
And so, speaking of kind of like industry, or just the machinations and comings of going of any business, I guess, and a group of people, the way I read it was, who was the brewery that sold? Actually, is it in my notes?
First
I think
one.
It was
Emerson's, and then
so someone sold it was Emerson's, and then on the Tuatara site it said along the lines of "We'll never sell out to a big."
No, that was Dominic.
Yeah.
That was Dominic Kelly down at Hachigazoki saying we never pour Emerson's again, and then our young head brewer went off and set up Panhead.
But there was some sort of thing where Tuatara basically said, "We'll never kind of sell out to big corporate." I mean, look, it's inevitable. It happens with business, right?
It was always in the back of your mind, most New Zealand businessmen, if you can get your business to a certain style.
Oh, it's the dream, isn't it, for a lot of people? I mean, the 42 below story or whatever,
And if you get to 1% of the national market, then DB or Lion.
Is that the magic? So I was going to say, so they rung it. I don't know who Rangatira Limited or
they bought into they bought shares in the brewery. I can't remember what our motivation for that was.
To get it ready for sale, make it more attractive to a big brewer.
Yeah. Well, they were originally the McKenzie's Supermarket Trust. When they sold McKenzie's, they set up to Rangatira 1 and 2 to buy into businesses promote them along and build them up and see what happens in that.
So McKenzie's is before my time as a supermarket chain. So since then they've been like a venture capitalist kind of firm.
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And what I'm just trying to gauge is where you were through all of this. Like, you were still a partner? Yeah, you were still on the board. But you'd stepped back from, you weren't doing hands-on stuff at the brewery so much anymore?
I sort of got off the board when sort of Rangatira came along. And then they sort of run it to get with the board, and then DB made us an offer we couldn't refuse.
And this is the bit that's super interesting, and you know, I'd love you to tell me as much as you want, but it is that dream of like building up something to that point. Yeah, like I asked you on the phone yesterday, and you said, "Yeah, we did all right, but we wouldn't have." And I didn't catch the end, but something about right, timing, whatever. Right.
Yeah,
because I think I basically said to you, Fraser, so everyone knows. I said I kind of was trying to sort of like gender. Said, "So is it live out the rest of your life kind of money that you made?" And you were like,
"If I kept the amount of shares I had originally in the brewery, yes, it would have been."
That's what you were saying, though. I didn't catch,
but
right.
Unfortunately. Okay. With family demands and stuff like that, and I just whittled my share values down. So in the end, I end up with this house, which I'm quite happy about.
Yeah, and then the other thing is, like, if the personalities that would look back on something like that and go, "I messed up," well, that's gonna run the rest of your life.
What can you do?
Exactly. And by the way, this house is freaking lovely, folks, and it's out in White Plains, on the coast.
What's his name? Young, who's the guy, Morgan, who set up Trade Me?
Oh, I know who you mean. Yeah. Can't remember the name. His dad's all over the shop now, publicly.
Anyway, Sam. Yeah. So Sam Morgan came in before I even had a computer and said, "Oh, I'm going to set up online classified and they $1,500 and you can be a shareholder." And I just got off the phone with some good bandit wasn't going to come, and I was fucked off. And I said, "No, that'll never work."
To the Trade Me guy.
So he scuttled off, and I thought, "Oh, wait a minute, that might have worked." And when I looked for him, but he'd gone. I said, "Yeah." But that was another one of those ones you think.
Last thing on the sale. I don't. It might be. Was it publicly? Was it publicly released? What the sale was? What it sold for?
31 and a bit mil. I think.
Wow, goodness, that's a lot of millions.
Well, yeah, we started off with 80,000.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. It was just the industry. It was one of those industries that went ballistic.
It is, and it feels like good luck to everyone. But yeah, I think it goes without saying. It feels like there's a lot of people trying to
do it now.
Get something happening now. I mean, good luck to Tim with Abandon. Seems like he's chipping away with that.
Beer the other day down at the Parkock Bowling Club.
You're roasting coffee, and it's fascinating what you told me. You're involved with a guy that has set up a basically pay for play roasting operation.
Yeah, it's like Gypsy Brewing.
Yeah,
you know, he's got the facilities
in Central Wellington. In Paraparaumu.
And you go down and pay your price per kilo to use the up to date modern roasting gear, everything you need, and there's no rent, there's no power, there's no HP. And I go down there and roast off a few. I think I had 11 single origins for the Christmas market.
How many kilo in total?
Oh, you have to do smallest batches of three.
Does he broker the beans? Do you buy the beans off him, or do you?
No, he doesn't charge anything extra for the beans. He will just order them in for you. And
so that flat rate of $8 a kilo is including the beans?
No. You pay for beans on top, and then beans on top.
Yeah.
And so, but when you having run a business, not having it means there's no overheads.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
And you've got that long-term brand, as we talked about, because you're calling them Beans Bodega, right?
Yeah, called Beans Bodega. And I haven't, you know, sooner or later I'll get the artwork done, and sooner or later I'll get to a point where I can sort of make it
Where do you sell it now?
Just at the local farmers market.
Great.
Yeah.
And, that's enduring. That's an enduring brand. That's interesting to hear that you're grilling. And lastly on that, how did you learn how to roast coffee?
By going down there, he taught me.
He does that as well. That's amazing.
Yeah. It's great because you rock up there, you meet Pete at the roastery, and you know, everybody else is doing blends, and I kind of felt like having a craft beer background, I wanted to do like, you know, find out what each hop is like or each bean's like. So I've been doing that.
So it's now, like you're doing a single malt whiskey rather than a blend.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so now I've sort of done, been through around most of them, and now I'm going to start looking at probably doing a blend.
That's
good. And then once you get to that point, then I can go maybe sort of set up a little company and then start approaching.
I'll let you go. You're going to go surf later today. This beach and what, longboard?
A longboard at Peka Peka today.
Nice.
There's a swell turning up towards the end of the day, and there'll probably be a surf in the morning, a nice 16-second sort of period.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's one of the things I love about living back out here. Is to surf Peka Peka when I was, you know, in the sixth form. And going back and doing it again.
It's funny how things go full circle.
Yeah.
Thanks, Fraser. It's been a pleasure.